Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So we're here to review the Sunday papers as ever, and we will start with the headlines as ever. So Sunday Independent is what I have first. We are on Facebook and all our social channels, as well as the radio, if you want to watch us as well as listen. So Sunday Independent, go with Kerry yesterday. Kerry survive. Resurgent Cork let Kingdom off hook. That was Kerry's 119-310 win over Cork yesterday. Porky Queeve. Cork fans, you'll be happy to see Colm O'Rourke here on the bottom half of the page. The headline of his piece is, "The good news for the Rebels is they have a team again," which was the takeaway a lot of people had from yesterday's match. Sunday Times next here, a picture of Gavin White lifting the Munster Championship trophy yesterday at Porky Queeve. Kerry take Munster crown after a 119-310 win over Cork. Kingdom rule is the headline. Bottom half of the page, backlash against FAI plans. We'll come on to this in a moment. This is the chairman of the Schoolboys FAI, John Early, who is not impressed with the new FAI plans. And then over on the right-hand side, Duncan Castles here. Neymar Coutinho swap, says Duncan Castles. So it seems Barcelona prepared to pay PSG up to 90 million euro for 27-year-old Neymar, plus they will give PSG either Philippe Coutinho or Ousmane Dembele. And it seems that Neymar is willing to take a fairly hefty pay cut as well to make the move back to Barcelona. Back page of the Sunday World, Coutinho no. That's John Aldridge, he's their columnist in the Sunday World. He doesn't think Liverpool should go near Philip Coutinho if he becomes available anyway, given the circumstances under which he left. Then the Sun, a few different things here. Keane Edge, Kingdom Crown, this is Peter Keane, who in the piece is saying he didn't think the performance was up to scratch in many ways, but they won nonetheless. And then top of the page, Didier Drogba confirming last night Lampard is in talks with Chelsea. That was at a Q&A. And it seems as well, a picture of Paul Pogba. The headline, "Get out. United pals want Pogba to leave." This is Ken Lawrence. Apparently, Paul Pogba's teammates at Manchester United think he should leave, according to Lawrence there. That's an exclusive. He is not unpopular in the dressing room, says Lawrence, but many want to concentrate on a new start, is the feeling he's picked up on. Sunday Mirror then, again, it's Kerry yesterday, and again, it's a picture of Gavin White lifting the trophy. Kerry spirit wins the day in Cork victory, but manager isn't happy at the level of his side's performance. So a similar theme there. And finally, picture of David Clifford, back page of the Mail on Sunday. Kerry fright night, Kingdom on the ropes after Rebels' rousing goal blitz. Three goals conceded by Kerry. It will give them food for thought. Peter Keane also here hailing the fighting spirit, and a picture of David Clifford on the back page. Mark O'Shea here is writing in the Mail on Sunday, defending is a dying art, and that plays into Dublin's hands. So they are your back pages anyway. We're joined in studio again by Timmy McCarthy. Good to have you with us. Of McCarthy Consulting, in your day-to-day life, and then four Olympic Games for RTE on the basketball. People will know your basketball commentary and a Ryder Cup and former Irish captain and coach as well. Good to have you back with us.
Good to be back, Joe.
Thanks very much for joining us. And journalist Gary Doyle here as well. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Joe.
So, a few different bits and bobs going on. It would be remiss of us not to note yesterday was the last Times Ireland edition. You were obviously a big part of that. I would presume a very difficult couple of weeks, months.
It's been a funny time. It's been a mixture of a lot of honour in terms of other reporters have been really good, really encouraging, really positive, and there's just been a nice sense of human decency come out of people, sort of contacting you to say, sorry you've lost your job, bloody blah, but it's been good. And against that, there's also a sort of a sense of mourning that a paper that you were proud to work on, that is now over, and your colleagues that you get on really well with, that you're not going to work with them again. So it's been a bit of a mixture, but Sinead, you bounced back.
How long were you there?
4 years.
Enjoy it?
Yeah, it was great. It was good paper. We built it up. The sales weren't good. The best way of describing it, Joe, is it's like the 1980s transported to 2019. We're modern day newspapers are the 1980s coal industry. It's in decline, and we were the unprofitable pit that Thatcherites decided to shut down. And that's reality, and it's annoying, but I can't say I was surprised by the decision.
So was it one of those things where even from a year ago, 2 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago, you felt was on the long finger but coming?
From day one, the day I went in there, I knew it was a risk going there. The company had made me redundant 8 years ago when I was with the News of the World. So anybody who goes into journalism now goes there with their eyes wide open. There is a strong chance that you will be made redundant, which is, you know, it's a business that we love. It's a passion. You don't do it for the money.
No.
But you do it because you love writing, you do it because you love sport, and you do it because what else would you want to do? If you're not capable of playing sport, playing sport at an elite level, the next best thing is to be there in the stands writing about it. So if I had any sense, I'd get out of the business now, but I don't have any sense, so I'm not going to get out of the business. It's just too much fun. And
did you consider getting out?
Yeah.
Every journalist does, I think, at the moment.
It would make sense to get out, but if you're passionate about something, you don't get out of it because you just know that there will be opportunities out there. You know that you're good and you know you're going to get opportunities, so you hang about.
And does the current climate dent your passion at all? Like, does your passion...
For sport, no.
Does the passion that you have for writing and the love of it not become almost intertwined with the worry and the stress and the sense of foreboding?
No. You know, rightly, I'd say I'm a bit like one of those characters in Chernobyl. Like, you know, you've got that radioactive toxicity coming off you because you've closed two newspapers. So prospective employers are no doubt looking at me and saying, if we get him, we're going down. So we're not going to go near him, right? But in terms of diluting your passion for it, no way.
No way.
No way whatsoever. Like, you know,
because I wouldn't want there to be like a Pavlov's dog effect. Like, no, this thing, I love it, but it also brings me just so much stress. And
I can't bother getting stressed anymore. No, like, I mean, there's so many good papers in Ireland. And one thing I'd like to say, apart from the fact that so many colleagues have been so generous, and apart from expressing my gratitude to those guys, the other thing I'd like to say is, yesterday on the newsstands there were nine Irish newspapers. Tomorrow there are going to be eight. So anybody that tunes into this show has got a passion for two things. Number one, sport. Number two, newspapers. Okay, because this is the paper review. Therefore, they all have a choice tomorrow to go to the newsstands and to buy a paper. So you've got eight really good papers, and I'm a fan of all eight. And they've got different strengths and they've got different styles. But there's some hidden gems tucked away within those newspapers on different days as well. There's some columnists that are rated really highly that don't get a lot of credit or a lot of publicity, such as Neil Reardon on a Tuesday on what he has to say about Irish football. Colm Keyes on a Tuesday sums up the championship weekend in a way that nobody else does as effectively. A big fan of the Herald during the summer, big fan of all the tabloids, big fan of all the broadsheets as well. People should go support the papers, so to make sure that in a year's time that we're not talking about the demise of another paper, and they were saying there's only seven on the newsstands, or six, or five. So people do have a choice. People can keep this industry alive. But my attitude is, you've got to go out and support it. And that starts with journalists as well. We have to go out and buy newspapers rather than hook. Like, I mean, Twitter has become a major reason for the demise of papers because journalists are giving stuff away free on Twitter. Instead of, like, I can't understand that, like, you know, because you have the opportunity of protecting your employment by not hawking yourself around on social media for free.
There's going to be a major cultural shift now to rein that back in and put paywalls up and stop giving stuff away. That's going to be a big change, but it probably has to happen for the industry. Are you optimistic for the industry in a market this size?
No.
Yeah.
But I'm not. I'm not optimistic for the industry.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. If you look at the sales of newspapers now compared to 10 years ago, they've decreased dramatically. I would be optimistic for the industry in the sense that when I started in 98, the standard of sports journalism in this country has improved dramatically. I think, like, this is a Sunday paper review, but if you were to do this programme on a Tuesday, a Wednesday, or a Thursday...
You could do it any day.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. Yeah. Tommy Martin, midweek, great columnist. Kieran Shannon, really talented columnist midweek as well.
Great interviewer as well.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of, and look, I'm doing a disservice to a lot of journalists by not mentioning them here, by name checking.
No, we understand, you're just picking out random examples.
Yeah, but there's serious quality. The Star on a Saturday, Inside Sports section, that's been going for I think 25 years now. Like, one other thing to mention, Joe, I don't think people realise the work ethic of so many journalists. Like, there's this guy, Paul Keane, I'd say he produces about 25,000 words a week. Like, that's a serious grow for sport and for working. And the Herald have only three, to the best of my knowledge, they have three full-time sports reporters. The Star have five, the Mirror have three, the Sun have four, and they're producing 7 days a week. Like, that requires guys with a serious love of sport to keep doing that week after week, day after day, year after year. And you don't do that unless it's what you're passionate for. You definitely don't do it for the money.
No.
It's a
dreadful time for everybody involved, and it is different to if you were an accountant in a small or medium-sized business which had to make you redundant. You'll probably know you'll find a good job relatively soon, whereas you're now being cast back out onto a market which is dwindling. So it's not easy for anyone who's lost their job. Being made redundant is dreadful at the best of times. This is not the best of times for journalists. So you're back out trying to, for a lot of people, work the freelance market, which is no fun either.
Now, freelance market is a tough gig. I've done it as well, and I wouldn't recommend it. But look, why did you get into it, Joe, and why did I get into it? It's because it's what you want to do. Like, I remember when I left college in 97, I was a tour guide briefly, the worst tour guide in the country, got my fellow tourists lost mid route around Dublin. I was a tax consultant, and
Sensible, earn a few quid.
Yeah.
Go back into tax consultancy, no?
No. And this is what, you do what you enjoy.
Yeah.
Because once you do a job that you enjoy, you don't work a day in your life. So it's a cliche, but it's true.
Mm. Timmy, you're looking on at the industry. I mean, you've obviously been involved with RTE and gone to Olympic Games and Ryder Cups, and you've a taste of the media world, I guess. It's never good when a paper closes, that, to say the least.
No, I think the point Gary made is very valid, though. Not just in newspapers, but, you know, it needs support. You know, we talk about sport. We all love sport. That's why we're here today. You know, why don't the women, you know, fill Croke Park for women's Gaelic football? And, you know, we talked 50,000 this year, and it was great, but why not 80,000, you know? We need to support things, and the newspaper industry is one where, you know, people still like news, particularly sports news in a country like this. And, you know, we import a lot, we take a lot of stuff from the UK and you know, as, you know, easy to take. But I really believe that, you know, the loss of the Times and other papers that may follow is sad for the industry, but sad for our country, because your point about an accountant can get a job in some other place, you know, where the journalists will find it harder because the pool is so small, is very valid. But I think the thing is that we need to support industries that go through tough times. And, you know, the analogy Gary made was the coal mines in the UK. That's a different analogy, I would say, because, you know, there could be, you know, health factors and other things. But I think the newspaper industry, you know, just needs support. It just needs people, you know, to spend X amount of money every day or every second day just to support the industry, because there's really quality stuff comes out. And what I find even in the Sunday paper reviews, you see a little snippet that, unless you buy the paper, you don't see. And we don't talk about it down in the restaurant, in the pub or at home, because it's just not what we talk about. And I think it's very sad that, you know, the Times has gone. It's gone for commercial reasons, whether they're valid or not. You know, that's for the people who made that decision commercially. But I've always looked at, you know, overseas papers or overseas businesses with interest in Ireland. And it's a small market, so they've got to understand that. So when they look at things like profitability, it's very easy to say, well, Greater Manchester will make more money than Ireland, you know, because the population of Greater Manchester...
10 million people, yeah.
So that's always a factor. But I do think that we, you know, as a nation, we don't support enough things. We talk a lot about things at times, but we don't support it by, you know, bums in seats, hands in our pockets for newspapers. I explained, you know, the Camogie and women's football, which has tremendously developed over the last 10 years, but they still can't fill Croke Park. Yet, on our final day, 40,000 women will be at the men's final. you know, hurling and football. So, you know, we just need to be more convinced and committed to supporting, you know, industries like, you know, like the sports journalism and news journalism and sports, where, you know, we just need to be more committed to that. Mm. Less talk at times and more action would help us save some of the jewels that we're losing. And the one I've always learned in business and in sport, you don't get them back. When you lose a jewel, you know, it ain't easy to recover jewels. You know, they come in different guises, but they don't come back as smoothly as we think, you know. Mm.
AI story is on the front page of the Sunday Times. It's worth just touching on. I know, Gary, you suspect there's a bit of FAI fatigue out there, and I'm starting to detect it myself. It's definitely slowing down in terms of excitement levels. The situation at the moment, if you were to sum it up, and it's on the front page here of the Sunday Times, and there's a piece in the Mail on Sunday about it on page 71 there, is that a set of recommendations have been put forward, and they include the schoolboy seat at the board of the FAI being shared, so not being an automatic full-time seat at the board. And so the chairman of the schoolboys FAI, John Early, has resigned. He resigned on Wednesday over the plans to abolish their automatic right to a seat. This is following Aidan Horan of the Institute for Public Administration. He headed up a review group. So they've put forward a load of recommendations which the FAI want to try and accept in full. You suspect, really, just to try and smooth everything over as quickly as possible. One of those recommendations is that the schoolboy seat wouldn't be an automatic. And John Early has resigned. He says, I'm very disappointed when Aidan Horan, who's head up this review committee, addressed the board and told us we were all culpable for what had happened. This is Early speaking yesterday, the schoolboy representative speaking yesterday. I don't think that schoolboy football has any culpability. If John Delaney made a 100 grand loan and we never even knew who signed off on that, I wasn't aware of it. I was never told who said afterwards that I was aware of it. I'm still very unhappy. So it seems what's going to happen here is that there's going to be the AGM, and the FAI want to push through the recommendation, but certainly they won't have the support of the schoolboy votes, which are sizable. That's the general gist here.
Yeah, like, I mean, if anyone thinks, firstly, that this story is going to fade into the background, they're off their heads. This is going to go on, I'd say, for another couple of years.
Yeah, that's my worry.
Yeah.
We're into a saga here.
The fatigue element, it's funny, like Paul Rowan and Philip Quinn, the two guys that we're referencing here, they're dogged. The FAI aren't going to get away with anything without those two guys making sure that everything's above board. Mm-hmm. They're not shy about asking the hard question. In terms of the level of fatigue, people...
We're sports journalists a bit. It was striking, it was Mark Tighe who made the breakthrough.
Yeah.
So
point being,
shouldn't a sports journalist have led that charge over the previous decade?
Have you not been reading the papers in the previous decade?
Yeah.
Okay, well, in 2010, I wrote a piece saying it's time for John Delaney to go for the News of the World.
Yeah.
I got the sum total of the reaction to that piece were two letters from schoolboy clubs saying how great to my sports editor, how in God's name they knew who my sports editor was remarkable. Mm. I have no idea how they found out. And the point that they were making was, this is rubbish journalism, you can't be allowing this to happen. Mm-hmm. There was zero reaction otherwise. Nobody cared. None of the politicians that have been jumping up and down, waving their hands.
Oh, well, that's just opportunism.
Exactly, you know, that's
latent.
My point.
Yeah. But so, in terms of almost the smoking gun or the evidence, I guess, or the story, like the 100 grand loan or the other bits and pieces, mm-hmm. Do you think there's an argument that actually over the
nobody
past 10 years...
Joe, nobody has been shy. Absolutely no...
Or everyone's critiqued him and his behaviour, but in terms of actually getting the story to...
That's good journalism on Mark's behalf. Mm. And also, there's a couple of guys in The Sun who aren't getting the same... plaudits.
No, that's true.
Neil Cotter's work on this story has been exceptional, and he continues to get story after story. Even, like, I mean, the fatigue element that's kicked in with the reader.
Yeah.
Neil has been knocking on the door, hasn't been shy at all about asking the hard question and doing the graft to get really good stories. Sometimes you just get lucky. I'm sorry, I don't mean to dismiss Mark's work as luck.
I know what you mean.
But like, Paul Rowan has been dogged after Delaney since 2005. And I wouldn't say there's one football reporter on the beat that hasn't asked serious questions of John Delaney and the FAI and are continuing to ask serious questions. So fair play to Mark for getting it, but who got the winning goal for Portugal in the Euro 2016 final? That doesn't mean that Ronaldo wasn't a key reason for their victory as well. If Paul hadn't have... I forget the name of who got the goal in 2016. I know he played for Swansea on loan for a bit.
Was it Elber or something like that? It's a left-footed strike from distance.
I can picture the goal, but my point being that if the climate hadn't have been there, would the editors have encouraged Mark Tagg to go hunting for
looking.
That story?
It's a fair point. It's a fair point.
And there were a lot of times when journalists were told by their editors, back off now, we're worried about the legalities of this situation. The readers aren't interested in the story. Let it go. And it's to the credit of Rowan and Quinner and Paul Lennon and Emmett Malone and Dan McDonald, absolutely every one of us. Again, I'm leaving names out here, apologies to them. They never let up. They never let up, you know?
Yeah.
If anybody let up, I disappeared for 5 or 6 years from the story, which I'm embarrassed about, you know? I wasn't shy at one stage about having to go, and then it didn't do much. Mm. So I'm not going to criticise any other colleagues for the fact that Mark got the story. Fair play to him for getting it, but plenty of credit should be shared around to the other chaps in the press box.
It's a good answer. Why did you go away from it for those years? All of the above reasons?
I can't remember. I got bored. Do you know something? Like we're talking earlier before we came on air, I find administrative stories seriously, seriously boring. And even though this is a really important issue, and I've never once gone to, when I was growing up, I didn't want to watch an FAI council meeting or an FAI AGM. Do you know one sports fan that does?
No, it's not why you get into the business.
It's not why you get. I couldn't care. I have strong views on it. Mm-hmm. I think the entire board should go. I think quite a few others should go as well. Mm. I'm extremely angry as a football fan that Brian Kerr has been dumped out of Irish football and Owen Hand. Mm. I can't understand why Pat Fenlon and Trevor Crowley aren't involved. I'm really, really annoyed that football is run the way it is run in this country. Mm. For somebody who is a fan and also somebody that got involved with at coaching and being secretary at a couple of clubs. So there are brilliant administrators in this country, but they tend to stay underneath the radar and away from it. So the boys are doing us a service, but
for sticking on it.
Well, in terms of how it reads,
I don't think the fatigue should be allowed to develop in this, Joe. I think that's a very dangerous position for journalists to allow happen. I think that this is a huge issue for this country. I think that it takes courage to stay with the story now, because what looks like, if you take the front page that we talked about, Paul Rowan, is that, the FAI are going to, take this report and implement it fully, if they can get the numbers, obviously, when the AGM comes on in July, in that sense. And that doesn't mean that this report is the right way forward either. It just means that these group of people have decided that, in light of the current situation, this is the way forward. And if you take the schoolboys being ousted, as is commented on here, in that sense, that to me would not be a good thing for any organisation to have no participation by such a key
on the board. But they'll have to share their seat in the board, which they're unhappy with.
Yeah, but I also, but I think that, in the sense of this story, we're now at a stage where, this could easily just get whitewashed. And, John Delaney, his role, his current role, whether that will be maintained or will just part of employment issue going forward.
Yeah.
But the reality here is that, there's been a lack of governance, in the FAI. For whatever reasons, for ineptitude, inability to act as directors, inexperience, volunteerism, whatever. There's a whole lot of things. And I think right now, this is the biggest sport in the country. I mean, more people play soccer than any other sport in this country. Mm-hmm. We can't afford, you know, to have an association of this magnitude not corrected. And, you know, the we're now in a political minefield. You know, you have ministers coming out now and saying, you know, well, it's great they'll implement the report and it'll all be lovely and rosy. It really won't. This really needs to be, you know, front and centre of every journalist's mindset, in my view. And the fact that there's fatigue, in my experience, fatigue comes from two things. First of all, the reader gets fatigued most times because the writers stop putting it out with the same interest in that sense. And then the writers get fatigued because, you know, their editors or the political minefield, you know, it gets too tough. I would encourage all journalists who are around the story to stay with the courage.
I don't think you've anything to worry about knowing these chaps.
Yeah, well, Paul Rowan's saying, so for these recommendations to be implemented that the review committee has come up with, they need a two-thirds majority at the AGM.
Yep.
So that's 140 out of 206 attendees. Yep. Already the schoolboys have 36 votes and it looks like they're going to go the other way because they don't want to lose their seat. So they are not signing up in favour of this. Paul Rowan suggests that the FAO want to get this whole report through. Like, they've taken every single recommendation, almost as a preemptive strike, he says, by those curious bedfellows of the FAI and Sport Ireland aimed at taking some of the sting out of the damning series of reports which are coming their way over the next few months. He says, even if that's the case, Paul Rowan, he's looked at the report and there's lots of good things in the report. So independent directors, a chairperson, all to be welcomed. He talks about a series of checks and balances which seem never-ending and appear to raise the spectre of much red tape. So he's saying in Rowan's piece that the report is actually good, although there's a real element within the FAI of trying to get this report through in its entirety because they know there's some bad stuff coming down the line, and it's much easier to say when that bad stuff comes down the line, well, look, we've put in all these recommendations, we've already cleaned up the house a little bit. So that's a little bit of what's going on. The opener to Philip Quinn's piece is great, actually, because he says that time has stood still in Abbotstown for way too long. The meeting room where Donal Conway, the FAI president, and Aidan Horan, the chairperson of this review group, briefed Sunday journalists. He says the clock was broken on the wall and the framed photo of the Republic of Ireland squad with Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane was taken in 2015. The little details, as Giovanni Travitoni used to say, may be relatively minor in the great scheme of Irish football, but they are a telltale sign of an organisation that's taken its eye off the ball. It's kind of a nice colourful image or start to that piece. He's saying similar things to Paul Rowan about the fact that the schoolboy people now are going to vote against this, the full report being implemented. So it remains to be seen where that goes.
And I think in any report there's going to be a lot of very good points. There's no doubt in that. But you know, if the report is going to be pushed in to stop some of the bad stuff coming online, that's a real risk. That's a real risk for any organisation in that sense. You know, my guidance would be, you know, if I was involved, would be, you know, let's get the bad stuff out. Like, we need to deal with this. If we want to really clean this up, like, we've got to take the bad stuff or whatever stuff is, you know, is coming down the line,
yeah,
and make it happen quicker. Because, you know, I thought for me, it was interesting that there was no questions allowed, you know, for any of the employees or ex-employees or current employees, which I thought was interesting because that's where the public interest has stemmed from in this whole situation about this 100,000 loan and then other aspects of, you know, this chief executive's, you know, benefits or perceived benefits in that sense. So what they're trying to do is, you know, whitewash all that for the moment, bring this in. The problem bringing it in is that they don't have the schoolboys on board, and 36 votes is a lot of votes that they don't have in that sense. And then, you know, hopefully at a point in time in the future, we'll say, well, now we've dealt with all the other stuff and it's great. And, you know, we've cleaned up the whole place. And, you know, you need to deal with the wounds first, you know, and then deal with the wounds. And, you know, then from the wounds, you know, lift up from the ashes. But right now, the FAI, you know, has a long way to go. And, you know, Gary mentions, you know, some people like Brian Kerr and other people that. But there's a really awful lot of very good people working in soccer.
Yeah,
you know, at all levels of administration.
And they're also people working within the FAI as well.
And the FAI. And I just think the sad thing is that they get all caught up in this and they lose their motivation. You know, if I was working, you know, with a group about, you know, setting a new vision, you know, you have to get buy-in. You have to get buy-in for a vision. And right now, you know, this new plan seems to have, other than political buy-in, which is expediency, you know, so they can get back funding, because I think Fergus O'Dowd made a point in Paul Rowan's is that, you know, we'll bring the sport back into the right territory, transparent, accountable, and getting the funding back. You know, it's more about that. It's more just funding is important, but if this is really meant to be a, you know, let's fix it properly,
genuine way,
it needs to be more than that.
Gary, where do you want to go next? That's the FAI, so that's in a couple of the papers today. What
Rory,
else caught you?
Rory, right? I want to.
Rory.
Rory McIlroy.
Okay, who's talking about Rory?
Okay, so David Walsh is talking about Rory.
Shows how famous he is that we don't have to give him a second name here.
There you go.
Only one Rory.
It's a really good line. It's a really good piece, actually, by David. And there's a good line at the end. He says, McIlroy has played great this year, just not in the majors. Koepka has played average this year, just not in the majors. You can argue whether this is because the American is mentally stronger or more because the superior all-round game holds up better in the heat of a major championship. Right, so this is my point, okay?
So just for people who haven't read it, because I know you're going to make your point first, to sum it up, he's basically looking at Koepka and saying...
Yeah, the piece is really about Koepka, but Rory gets referenced in it towards the end. Now, essentially, it's this piece sort of sums up the last 5 years of McIlroy's career in that he is perceived to have been not succeeding. And so I did a little bit of nerdy research in this. Firstly, he's won 4 majors, McIlroy. Only 5 Europeans have ever won more, only one of whom is still alive, okay? Since he won his last major in 2014, okay, he has finished in the top 10 in 9 different majors, more than any other player in the world. So this is a player who, I'm not saying Walsh didn't use the word failing, but essentially it's that sort of theme that McIlroy is not delivering. Okay. In addition to that, he's won 12 tournaments on the PGA and European tours. He has stayed in the world top 10. He has helped Europe to 2 Ryder Cup victories. He has had 9 top 5 finishes in majors in addition to his 4 victories. Okay. Now, what are we comparing him to? Are we comparing him to Koepka? Are we comparing him to the player we thought he could become? My argument is we should actually also be comparing McIlroy to where he stands in the history of Irish golf and also the history of Irish sport. He was number one in the world for 95 weeks. Only 3 players have surpassed that total in the history of golf. Also, and this is where the nerdiness really came in, and this was hour after hour after hour, from 1964 to 97, there was only one Irishman, Christy O'Connor, in 85, who led a major at the end of a day's round. Okay? In the 1970s, only one Irishman finished in the top 10 in a major. McIlroy, he's won at 4 majors, that's the starting point. He's had 9 top 5 majors. He's delivering. He's just not delivering the titles, but there's way more depth now than there were in the 1970s,
true, yeah,
when Nicklaus was winning as often as he had, as often as he did. So I actually think he gets a bit of a raw deal. I think I'm in a minority of one. Sorry, in this island, I'm in a minority of 2, myself and McIlroy. But I think he's achieving, like, you know, and okay, he's not winning, but I mean, the guys that are beating him are good players.
Did you read the piece to me?
I did. I don't think he said that. I don't think he actually, I have a different view than Gary on it. I think the McIlroy story is a fascinating story. I mean, he's an exceptional golfer. I think, you know, sometimes we take for granted, you know, when you take Gary's nerdy stats, what he has achieved, you know, which has been incredible. I think for most of us, the disappointment with McIlroy is that we expect him to be the successor to Tiger Woods. So you have 2 players in the history of golf, Nicklaus and Woods, who were exceptions to any situation, okay? And whether somebody like me thinks Woods was the greatest of all time or somebody else would think Nicklaus was, they're just opinions, but they separated themselves from everybody else. And we had a chance, we believe, with an Irish guy to be the third of that triumphant group in that sense. He then won 4 titles of majors before the age of 25, and we thought this world was going to be a phenomenal world. But there was always a challenge for McIlroy, and his putting was never the best. The one in McIlroy, even right through his amateur career, he was never the best putter. He was a streaky putter. He's probably the best driver, you know, in the game, has been probably ever, and people envy his driving in that sense. And over time, his iron and wedge play has become good and bad. But his putting is consistently... I heard a stat many years ago from a professional. At the time, Jason Day, Spieth, Justin Thomas and McIlroy were sort of in that quartet, that when McIlroy stood on the tee box from tee to green, he was 6 shots ahead of them in every tournament. And they were 10 shots ahead of him on the green. And so on the days he putted well, he was always going to be, you know, the winner in that sense. And I think what David Walsh, you know, my take on it is that you know, we've come to love McIlroy a bit more. I think his announcement played for in the next Olympics. So there's more of a love for McIlroy, I think, you know. He hasn't gone to La Hinch, which I think is a good decision for him, and we can talk about that later on. But Kepke is now the real deal as regards majors. And, and that's really where he focused on in that sense. And I just think the sad thing for Rory is that, you know, he can win more majors. There's no doubt. You know, how many more he win, time will tell. But the sad thing is that he's no longer the fairy tale we expected. You know, he's, you know, he now is just an exceptionally talented golfer who has four majors and may win more, but all the guys are catching up. And, you know, when you look at a guy like Woods, who won his 15th against all the odds in Augusta, it's hard at this juncture to see McIlroy have that longevity. Because,
you know, it's hard to see him have those numbers. Like, it's hard to see him jump from four.
Well, no, I don't ever see that would happen.
You just can't see that.
I mean, whether he'll win one more or two more, time will tell in that sense. But I think what David Walsh is saying, that, you know, Koepka is the real deal now in majors, and that where McIlroy succeeds in non-majors, Koepka doesn't succeed in non-majors and succeeds in majors. I don't think both of those are actually fully accurate, but in the sense that, you know, Koepka didn't win either last week, so, you know, both of them ended up, whether you're second or seventh or tenth, once you don't win it, you're an also-ran in reality in that sense, from my point of view, in the majors. But I think the thing is that David Walsh was saying, you know, McIlroy will win the popularity stakes in the Open, but Koepka has got what it takes to outscore him where it matters. In the majors. Mm. I actually hope David Walsh is wrong. I'd like to see McIlroy win more majors in that sense. And, you know, but even if he stopped today, you know, he's had a phenomenal career. And I just think that we're very hard on our sports people in this country, because we only want winners, you know, and we only want people to win, and we all love them when they win. And then we're
only want winners. How many winners have we ever had, though, in any sport?
Well, at the highest,
we've in terms of world number ones, Sean Kelly was world number one, okay? Beyond that, in boxing, Katie Taylor is world number one now. It's a very short list. This guy was number one for 95 weeks.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a phenomenal achievement. What are we judging him on? Are we judging McIlroy on the McIlroy we wanted him to be? Or are we judging him against a century of sport? Remember the hype that was generated by the Irish rugby team going to number two in the world? This guy was number one for 95 weeks. Rugby team didn't even make it to number one. Only eight teams play the sport.
Can
well,
we not judge him off the standards he set, the ability that we know he has,
I think that's what,
versus what he's producing now.
Yeah.
We're not judging him off what me and you can do. We're not judging him off Irish golf over the last 100 years. We're not judging him off Irish sport over the last 100 years.
But shouldn't
we're
we
judging
be,
him off his own talent. I think you can only judge people off their own abilities.
I think you can only judge McIlroy on how he executes in the current world. I think that, you know, we've given, you've given the stats, Gary.
Like some of those stats, you know, his top 10s in majors, if we're going by the McIlroy standard that he has set, I would like to know what percentage of those top 10 majors were reversed into. And by that I mean, blows himself out of the tournament on Thursday or Friday, no pressure on him on Sunday, and so often in that scenario, when he's tied for 35th, he goes out and shoots a 62 and finishes 8th. That has been a feature of his game far too often.
Yeah,
it was a real blessing, actually. It was a real rarity on Sunday last week when he was in the second final pairing and actually started a Sunday in the tournament. Because I guarantee you, so many of those top 10s, which are impressive, of course they are, but by the standards that McIlroy has set, a lot of those top 10s, by his standards, are just reverse in under no pressure, finish tight for 8. They're what I call Matt Kuchar top 10s, as opposed to Brooks Koepka finishing
But you've
second,
nine top fives
top
as well as the top
he'd,
tens.
He'd have reversed into a few of them, genuinely.
Yeah,
I'd like to know how far he was off the leader at the start of that day.
Okay, I'll put a question to you, right? If Shane Lowry gets in the top five in Portrush, what do you think that'll make headlines?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're judging Shane Lowry off Shane Lowry's abilities.
Right.
If Shane Lowry had won four majors in that space of time and produced that level of golf, then a fifth for Shane Lowry wouldn't cause any ripples. McIlroy finishes fifth, it'll be okay, it'll be good.
Mm-hmm.
By the standards he set, he's a victim of his own standards.
Yeah.
That's his problem.
Yeah.
Maybe the toughest thing you could say is, what a pity McIlroy didn't win one major every 4 years across his career.
Mm-hmm.
Then suddenly four majors.
But he was better than that.
He was better than that.
You know, see, Gary, I would, you know, develop Joe's point. he was better than that. I mean, McElroy was a superstar, you know, and like they talk about it even in some of the pieces.
But he's not dead yet. Like, I mean, he hasn't retired yet. Like, no. You know, he's got four.
No, but
there was a gap. There was a huge gap. Was it 70, 90, 86 between
Nicholas's
17th and 18th? The gap between Woods is 14th and 15th?
Circumstances are different, though.
This guy could end up with 8 or 9 in an era when there's more depth than there ever was.
Okay, but first of all, the circumstances are different now in that. So Woods' gap of 11 years, there was a huge amount of injuries in that period from that point of view, and there were some other off the courses. So that was the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, and we talked off camera and early on about, you know, Nicholas, you know, played in an era where the majors were dominated by all American players. There was very few overseas international players. Gary Player obviously was the exception. So he won an awful lot of majors against American players. He was beating every week in that sense from that point of view. My frustration for McElroy is that he has done an incredible thing in winning four majors by the time he did.
Yeah.
I think if he was sitting down today, you know, and inside himself, not talking to guys like us, he would say he should have won more up to now. That's the thing about it. And right now, you know, when you see for me, when I watch golf, I'm a big fan of golf. I never believe McElroy is going to win a major. Last week I watched Pebble Beach, and on the first tee box, I just never believed he was going to win the major.
That's Walsh's almost core point, that Koepka has this iron will about him, and McElroy has a sort of fragility in the pressure moments.
But the days McElroy will putt well, Joe, he will win the major. And I just think that we're judging McElroy against his own ability. Mm. He's not Shane Lowry, he's not Padraig Harrington, he's not Graeme McDowell or Paul McGinley. He is this exceptional talent. And as I said, his driving is the envy of practically every pro. He drives the ball straighter and longer than practically everybody. The pity for him is that there's a lot more people now coming in, and this guy Koepka has come under the radar. You know, if you think of he travelled the world, all the minor tours.
He's equaled McElroy's career in major terms in two years. Like, there is an argument that Harrington's three majors is a greater achievement than McElroy's four because of their individual
talents. Because he's maximised his talent.
Where I do definitely agree with you, Gary, is that when you step back from it all, when McElroy retires, when he's a 60-year-old, 70-year-old walking around, if he still only has four majors, people won't be saying he should have won a lot more. They will say, what a great career. It's a Hall of Fame career.
They might say both.
But that'd also, be accurate. I mean, he could easily get to, if he gets to six, what is he? Then he's level with Faldo as the best European.
Faldo behind us. Farden had seven, hadn't he?
Yeah, I think Palmer's seven. Like, look, McElroy wins the same number of majors as Arnold Bloody Palmer.
Well, look, he's one shy of Ballesteros' total.
Yeah. No, it's true.
That's remarkable.
It is. And yet, it's he did it in this glut, almost, and you thought, I think it's
and
because...
And it's not over yet. Like, you know, he's still...
The one thing... The
still
thing,
has 15 years
he does. No, he does. I think there's a great chance he'll win at least another... Well, let's put a number on it. What are we saying?
Another four.
Yeah.
I think if he wins one more, he'll do well.
Okay, on that bombshell.
Well, he won't do well if he wins one more, because remember... I just remember, this. The big thing for me, Joe, I remember watching the Open and watching the majors throughout the 1980s.
Yeah.
And there was never an Irishman, with the exception of Sandwich in 85, in the top 10.
Yeah.
Just didn't happen.
And
it did happen on two or three other occasions in the 80s.
Yeah.
And we've just been spoiled.
I know.
Spoiled, not just by McElroy, but also by the run when Clark won and McDowell and Harrington had his three.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I just think we've lost the sense of perspective that this is what happens on a regular basis. It doesn't,
True.
I'm glad I didn't live. I lived through half the 1970s, but I'm glad I didn't watch year after year.
I'd love to see McElroy win many more majors. I think that, you know, the competition has changed now in that sense. People can drive it as far as them.
Yeah.
So if you look at the technical aspects of the game, you know, his length has been negated by many in that sense.
That's the worry for him over the next 5 years, is the next generation of college kids.
Yeah.
They look at his driving and they say,
I can do that. You know, Koepka now is out there as long as him in that sense. And the difference is, you know, Koepka's short game is consistently under pressure, standing up more in that sense. But I'd love to see McElroy win more. I think if he gets one more, I'd be very happy for him.
Okay. Paul Pogba's turned up in quite a few places, and there are some good pieces about Pogba, who I always think is in some ways a tricky subject to write about, because he is just such a global superstar and it's hard to get close to him and the reality of a situation.
Hard to get close to anybody.
Well, it sure is, especially someone at this level. Northcroft certainly caught my eye. Jonathan Northcroft on page 7 of the Sunday Times. where effectively he's making the argument, he's talking about Pogba on the pitch, because so much of Pogba is off the pitch. Midfielder is good but not great, is the argument Northcroft makes. And I think he's done a lot of work in this piece and looked through the various stats.
There are two pieces that stand out on Pogba. One is Ollie Holt's in the Mail on Sunday, and one is Northcroft's. There's different styles in terms of how they report it. Northcroft doesn't just provide an argument. He's not just
It's not just an opinion.
Yeah, and he's not relying on it on style. He's providing substance to go with it. Like the one stat, and the stat is hidden deep in the piece, and you don't even know it off the top of your head. Like, you know, he goes that the starting point has to be his 16 strikes and 11 assists in 2018-19, a season in which almost one third of all the goals United scored featured the Frenchman's involvement. When I read that at that point of the piece, Joe, I was thinking, oh my God, I've got my opinion of this guy wrong, that he's much more influential than I was giving him credit for.
Yeah.
The piece goes on, he makes a continually... gives a very balanced... It's very hard to give an opinion piece that's balanced for that piece to stay in your mind and to end up giving credit for it. Yeah. Either vote for one side or the other normally when you write an opinion piece. Mm. But he's effective. Northcroft is prepared to be balanced and still be effective. So he's doing really well. We'll come later to the piece, and he goes, half of those goals were penalties. Only one was against the top six side. And only two of the assists were also against the top six side. He was joint eighth with Jamie Vardy and below Callum Wilson for total goal involvements. Mm. The bulk of his goals were assists, also arrived in United's flat track run just after Solskjaer arrived against the Makeweights in the Premier League. In other words, this guy has done a serious amount of research into making the point he's made, and it's made the really effective piece. Now, different style. You go to Ollie Holt. This piece, it's funny, it's sharp. He has also worked incredibly hard in this piece, Joe, but his work rate has concentrated on finding the right words to make his point. And he does so really successfully. So it's what you want on a Sunday is something that you don't know. Northcroft provides that with the evidence. Holt, what also you want on a Sunday is to enjoy yourself, to, you know, have a piece. Like, we're talking off air about a very serious piece written by Rob Draper about Platini. And to be honest, it bored the life out of me. It was very worthy, but very dull. Whereas here, I mean, this is an entertainment industry. We want to be entertained. Holt entertains us. Yeah. Where he says, the club have become, this is Manchester United, have become the Premier League equivalent of a giant wood chipper, chewing up the reputations of players and managers, devouring mountains of banknotes, and leaving a few piles of sawdust for us to show for it. It's a good turn of phrase, and it perfectly sums up United post Ferguson. Mm. All fur coat, no knickers.
Well, the jumping off point for the Holt piece is about Lingard as well, where he did that video tour of the apartment. If you haven't seen this, if you're not a social media person, Jesse Lingard was on holidays with Marcus Rashford, and as they were leaving the hotel, they did a little tour of the various rooms. And as Holt says, he wandered into one of the rooms and captured his friend Jamal Branker face down and gyrating with a pillow. And he uses that analogy, and he says that Manchester United now, it's like the perfect analogy for a club wallowing in its impotence while the conquests are being made elsewhere. So we say... Then we saw in the room, you know, mate gyrating against a pillow, and said, that guy is kind of Manchester United now. He's humping a pillow. That is who they've become, which is pretty good, in fairness.
Well, I actually saw a different style, actually, in Holt's. I think Holt's is writing about Manchester United. I don't think he's just using Pogba as an example of his story. He's actually saying, United are finished, and are finished for going to be finished for a long time, which is an interesting piece when I read his piece, because on the... Northcroft piece, as Gary said, it's an opinion piece, and he's backing up his opinion, basically that they should sell Pogba with facts.
That's the headline, sell now, spend wisely.
Yeah. So that's what he's saying on the Northcroft piece. But I think Holt is talking about something much more fundamental, which is the club, and, you know, the example you talked about there. I mean, there's a funny line, he says, at United the good times have gone away. All that's left now are some crumpled sheets and an urgent need to get the cleaners in, okay? Just to follow on your point about the gyrating. So he's making it clear that, you know, and he references Gary Neville later on saying it'll be 2 years before they win the championship.
Which is optimistic,
I would say. Which is, you know, very optimistic in that sense. Obviously, I meant the Premiership championship, not just the championship, because some Man United fans will be tweeting that they're still in the Premiership, and I do understand that. But I think he's his piece is saying United are in real trouble. I thought was the fascinating piece for me was the second last paragraph on the piece. The inventory is daunting. Owners who appear to be asset stripping the club, an executive vice chairman who's out of his depth, a philosophy that prioritises making money over glory, a stadium that looks moribund and weary compared to new developments of sports in Anfield, a squad stocked with deadwood and orderliness, players who don't want to be there, players who are awfully pleased with themselves, for men who have never won anything. Man United, the club, pretending to have sex in an empty bed, have a long way to travel before the good times are back. And that's very sad for a club of that standard.
Are you a Man United fan?
I'm a Chelsea fan. So, you know, so I look at, but I get no pleasure out of, you know, seeing, you know, a club who are so successful like this now look to be in a journey that is going to be a long way to recover any of the greatness.
Mm. By the way, the hook for Northcroft's piece as well is that today marks the start of Pogba's final year or penultimate year of his contract. United do a 12-month extension, so they actually need to decide soon enough what they're going to do with him, because it becomes a bit tricky as you count down a contract. And Pogba's said in the last couple of days it might be good to find a new challenge somewhere else. So he's saying for Woodward and Solskjaer that brings the matter to a head, and he's definitely of the opinion they should sell him. Because it seems if they want to keep him, they may have to give him the captaincy, they may have to give him $500,000 a week, he's saying. Interestingly, because it ties in with one of the back pages, some assuaging of a dressing room where some have tired of his self-absorption. So maybe there is the beginnings of a recognition within the dressing room that he mightn't be good for the overall
package. Yeah, like a key aspect of a really good manager, Joe, is not just being able to identify talent, it's also being known when to sell.
Mm.
And Wenger, during his good years at Arsenal, was superb at that. He sold Vieira at the right time. He got rid of
Overmars at a good time as Anelka at
Petit.
A good time.
Petit People forget that Petit wasn't the player when he left Arsenal for Barcelona that he was when they won the double in 97-98. So it's a really good skill to have. You have absolutely no doubt Ferguson would have got rid of Pogba.
And did once already when he was sticking his head up the parapet too much. He said, off you go.
I think what's interesting though, Joe, is that I spotted the piece on the
Mirror. Steve Bates you had, yeah.
And I think that, you know, so the sponsors have now come into play in this story, and they have said, you know, Adidas have said to United, you must keep Pogba. Mm-hmm. You know, we've supported you, we've given you a contract for $750 million over 10 years, a mega deal in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the deal was to use United's biggest stars to front up their advertising campaigns in Asia, Europe and USA. And they're now worried that this World Cup winning star, Pogba, if he goes, it damages their brand. So it's interesting to see, you know, you have the whole piece about United as a club, you have the Norcroft piece about Pogba and his inadequacies for somebody of his talent, and now you have a sponsor coming into sport again. And, you know, we've had examples of that obviously in this country in the past 12 to 18 months, you know, particularly in the rugby front, where sponsors have come in and, you know, given a position on their involvement with the club. And Adidas have now made it clear to United, if you take Steve Bates' piece, it's page 55 on the Mirror, saying, you got to keep him. So, you know, maybe Fergie would have got rid of him, maybe Wenger would have got rid of him, you know, but, you know, the sponsors didn't have as much influence as they appear to have now.
This is going to become the burning issue in sport in the next 5 years, because sponsors, they've raised their voice, they've made their opinion, and they're going to continue to do so. Mm. And there's going to be a major backlash against their influence on decisions that are being made on the pitch. They've no business going there. They're not experts on it. They have to stay well away, but they aren't going to. And it's going to become, you're going to be talking about this a lot, Joe.
Yeah, I would have thought so. In GAA terms, there are a few different bits and pieces. Dennis Walsh is looking at the fact that the GAA are participating in Dublin Pride for the very first time. I'm sure people are aware of that. He says, the Pride Parade in Dublin has been in existence since the early 1980s, growing in that time from fewer than 1,000 participants to more than 60,000 last year. In tone, it has changed from one of protest to one of exuberant celebration. Why has it taken so long, he wonders, for the GAA to be involved? He said the GAA had never been asked before, and maybe the GAA didn't look like an organisation that was waiting to be asked. For generations, it projected a conservative image bound up with the values of old Ireland and, to a degree, the Catholic Church. Wouldn't even say to a degree, bishops thrown in the ball. That has changed incrementally at first, and then, says Dennis, at a rattling pace. Talks to different people here, quotes different people, Donal Cusack, and Valerie Mulcahy as well here, who says of the importance of this happening. Unless you're in the LGBTQ community, you might not understand the significance of this. GAA get involved in Pride. She says, it's a wonderful message, just the whole idea of showing more inclusivity. Years ago, it wasn't really spoken about. It was never spoken about. In itself, that makes it seem like there's something wrong. So if anyone's saying, well, why did the GAA need to get involved in this? You know, what's, well, it's, you know, there's no need. Her point is the fact that it was never spoken about in itself, that makes it seem like there's something wrong. That's the importance for her. It's a good piece, I think.
It's a brilliant piece, Joe. And you know one thing that struck me about when I was reading this piece? I could have read another 700, 800 words on it. Mm. But one of the things about the Sunday Times is these guys are constrained to, I think it's a maximum of 1,100 per piece. So for somebody like Dennis, who is a world-class talent and is so consistent, he needs more space than what he's being given here. We had more space in the little brother's paper in the Times Ireland, we could go up to 2,500 if we wanted to, if we needed to. And like Tommy Conlon's piece on Leitrim last week, 5,000 words.
Yeah.
It was exceptional. The piece during the week on that sad trial.
That tragic trial. Conor Gallagher, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it was it 16,000 words?
16,000, yeah.
And I didn't stop reading it.
No,
if something is well written and if the subject is of interest, you will keep reading, particularly in a Sunday paper. Mm. And I think these guys deserve more space because they're really talented. The four Irish writers on the Sunday Times, Dennis, Mick, Paul Rowan and Peter O'Reilly, are top class operators. Mm. And to hold them back, it's a bit like that line Mick O'Dwyer said about Paddy O'Shea, whereby you're putting when he moved him from half back to cornerback, like, you know, and said, just you're stopping him, you're putting a chain on him, like you can't do that in the cold, like, you know. Mm. These guys are being constrained. This piece is brilliant. Mm. I could have read it for another 900 words.
I really enjoyed the piece. The fact that two of my fellow Corkonians, you know, were strong in the piece, Donal Cusack and Valerie Mulcahy. And they've been very strong, in fairness, in bringing this, mm-hmm. you know, to the fore. I love this little paragraph in Todd Colin from the left. And Donal Cusack was walking around Cork City on the day of the referendum when he got a congratulatory text from Gerry Adams, mm-hmm. the former president of Sinn Féin. And he said, Jesus, Gerry, this feels like a revolution. And then said, this is the closest we'll get to a revolution in our lifetime. I gave him an X at the end of it, a kiss sign. And I just think this was the mind frame that day. It was a liberating day and a liberating feeling. And then Valerie Mulcahy made a point saying, it's a wonderful message, just the whole idea of showing more inclusivity. I think it's critical for our country, you know, that the GAA stands up in this field, because I think that, you know, we've moved so far on as a country in inclusivity. And I just think that this is a really great development. It's a smashing written piece. And I just think that, you know, there are some snippets in it that really bring it to life. And I just thought, you know, imagine Donal Cusack and Gerry Adams, you know, talking about a liberation and a revolution. I just thought to myself, it was cool in that sense.
What I liked as well is it's not just everything is great kind of an attitude. There were two things which really jumped out at me as very significant. So Dennis has talked here to Garoj O'Wellvickle. Excuse me, Garoj, if I've mispronounced your surname. Garoj is chair of the GAA's gender diversity workgroup. I must confess, I didn't know the GAA had a gender diversity workgroup. And he's talking about almost the next frontier for inclusivity in the organisation. And he said, well, of children who are gay, he said, we're getting calls from parents saying, my child is gay, he doesn't feel part of it. And we're trying to intervene at the moment on a one-to-one basis in those cases. And then just to make the world a whole lot more complicated, and it's happening now, it's not really in the future, he said, the GAA at the moment are helping five children who are in the process of transgendering, one as young as 5 years old. He said, their parents have come to us, and in all five cases we have tried, so far successfully, to integrate those children into our association. The first two were in Dublin. The parents had already done work with the schools, and they wanted us to do work with the GEA. The five-year-old was born a girl, and her parents wished that we categorise her as a boy in the association. They've met psychological services, and time will tell for that family. In the meantime, we've facilitated what they wanted. That is just a snapshot of just how complicated life is going to get for associations like the GEA. It's fantastic they're trying to get ahead of it. He's saying they're working on a policy document at the moment, which I look forward to reading, because that's not easy territory.
No, but fair play to them. The funny thing is the GEA still has a reputation for being incredibly conservative as an organisation.
Yeah.
The last 20 years, they've been so radical in comparison to how they were up until then.
True, because they always move slowly, but so much has changed.
They are moving slowly, but at least they're moving, you know.
The other thing,
I'd really want, for Mulcahy and Cusack to come out and speak as publicly as they have, it's just so brave, and they just have to be admired for doing this. And they're helping so many people.
Mulcahy makes the point actually on that, where she says, so Dennis writes, over the last couple of years, a host of high-profile ladies football and camogie players have spoken about their sexuality.
Yeah.
And they do so, I think, in a way which is, you know, as Dennis says, they just weave a reference to a girlfriend.
Yeah.
It's not like an announcement. It's just me and my girlfriend were away and now we're, you know, we're back and I'm playing a match at the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Mulcahy, I don't know how that would be perceived in a male changing room, but certainly for women, it's become just be who you are. There doesn't seem to be the same judgment, which is great. People live their lives, love who they love, they get on with their sport. More people speak, the less stigma. So certainly there's less of a...
That's a great line. The more people speak, the less stigma.
Mm. Well, there's less references to my boyfriend in male GA.
But I think that's just part of the journey. I think that, you know, as somebody who obviously has been in dressing rooms in many situations as a player, obviously, and as a coach, there's an uncomfortableness at times about sexual things in male dressing rooms, even though you think that there's actually more comfortableness about it.
It's almost an immaturity.
There's an immaturity
which covers up the
uncomfortableness in that. So I think that, you know, the fact that, you know, Valerie talks about that in the female dressing rooms, it's become more natural.
Yeah.
I think it's only a matter of time, and thankfully so, it will become natural in the male dressing
room. I think it'll be a tough journey, actually.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I just think...
I would have thought there'll be almost universal support. And
hope there is.
Second or third person, it practically won't be a story.
I hope it. Well, I certainly hope that. I hope it's an easy journey, but I don't think it will be.
We'll see the GAA marching in Pride this Saturday. Then, just one. This was just like the quintessential piece. I saw the headline, I kind of thought, oh, that's interesting. And I started reading it and I read to the very end because it was beneath the Pride piece and it had like lots of gems in it I hadn't fully realised. It's really good. Like, we're all aware now, dummy teams are basically just the norm in every respect in GAA. So Dennis Walsh, again, having a good day on page 5 of the Sunday Times, Dennis.
Joe, that's the thing. Dennis Walsh has a good day every time he writes.
Yeah, no, it's true.
That's what I mean. He's world class. And he's consistently good.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to produce. It's not easy. Some people produce a good piece once a year. This guy does it week after week after week. And he's not alone in that respect. Mm. In this country, we have got some top class sports writers. And we're not talking about one or two. We're talking about 10 or 20.
Mm.
And I'm aware that there are news sections to newspapers as well. I've just never really got around to reading them too often because the sports sections are just way better.
I think it's a great piece because I think he shows the stupidity of it at times. I think the one about Gerald Hocknan and the Galway team, that as the team were on the parade, the players didn't even know who the team was.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. And I have to say, as somebody who's been involved in sport, I think that's criminal. I think that, you know, I've coached players in different codes, and you need the players to understand what you expect of them well in advance of, you know, the parade in that sense. But I thought the last line was brilliant for me. The last, he tells about, you know, the fact that Brian Cody in the last couple of paragraphs has now even become part of this dummy team process.
He says he was the one manager down the years who never got into that.
He
nonsense.
Was the exception, and you know, but last weekend, and you know, he now apparently has got into the last Saturday night. But he says, don't matter. Somebody this summer will have the boldness to name a team and stand over it. you just won't believe it. And that's the sad thing, you know, because if you look at, you know, if you look at the Premiership, you know, they name their team and it's the team. There's no, you know, they can have different.
They only name it an hour before kickoff.
But they name it, you know, in that sense, from that point of view.
I think there's a lot to be said for going that way, actually. Now, I know programmes, you like having teams in the programmes, but it's just not working.
Yeah.
Whereas, at least for radio and TV and journalists at the ground, if the team was named an hour beforehand, then actually on the TV coverage, you could say, right, let's actually talk about the team now.
Yeah.
Fair enough, you might be able to talk about it on the Friday evening on a radio show or in a paper, but at least you'd know on the hour before, and everybody in the stadium could then go, geez, what do you think?
Still, but the rugby teams, guys, the rugby teams name it 2 days before it.
I can't get my head around the stupidity of that. Why would they give the opposition team that advantage? And why,
Days before, you mean?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's stupid. It's archaic. Yeah. Well,
the rule is from 2015. Dennis writes, 9 a.m. on Thursdays, 2 hours before the print deadline for match programmes. Yeah. So that's the logic.
Mm.
And once those 26 players have been registered, no other player can be parachuted into the squad. Counties who don't comply face fines of up to £1,000, although, as Dennis says, nobody so far has received a ban for the fine. Is it that we have a certain tradition of the match programme having the team?
Yeah.
That's what it seems to be tied up in.
Yeah,
but
it is.
But now, I think it's damaging to match programmes now, because everyone's like, what's the point in buying the match programme?
Yeah, I think it could be dead right as well.
You know?
Yeah, I
it's
think
serious. Like, these guys, okay, it's not their livelihood. Well, they might get a few expenses. But it is too serious. Like, if you take a team, that team means the world to you, right?
Yeah.
And if you're in charge of a team, you cannot be giving away your state secrets 3 days beforehand. I think it's absolutely crazy that this practice still goes on.
But as Timmy says, rugby do it.
Stupidly. Not saying they're right, just because they do it doesn't mean they're not thick.
If both teams do it.
Then both teams do.
Then it's a fair amount of stupidity on both sides.
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't think it's stupidity. All right. First of all, I think what is stupid is that a traditional programme is determining
the deadline.
So that's stupid. So you know, we should move on from that in that sense. And whether it is the day before, 2 days before, 3 days before, or an hour before the game, you know, we should name the teams.
Yeah.
But I've always believed, you know, when you're involved in sport, you're scouting the opposition. And it doesn't really matter who they bring on, because you've scouted all of these players. I can remember, you know, at the national level, you know, we would play against teams. We would know every single one of their players. We'd have videoed them, we'd have scouted them, we'd know their strengths, their weaknesses, and we would try and, you know, deal with it at best. And in basketball, like, people can come on and off. So, like, the starting five becomes irrelevant, because you can bring a player on immediately afterwards. So, so I don't think there's any stupidity in rugby naming their team 2 days before it, because I think from the player's point of view, and you know, there's a nice thing to understand that they can talk about the things that they can help each other with in that sense. But I think there should be a consistency. I do believe what's stupid right now is a programme is determining the announcement of the team.
Yeah.
So I don't care when they announce the team, whether it's 2 days, 3 days, or 1 hour, once they both teams have to announce it at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, because at the end of the day, guys, you know, like, when you think of all the dummy teams down all the years, how many of them have worked in reality?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, look, the fact that Brian Cody didn't in his palm says everything. I can't believe the Lochnan one, that he only told them after the parade. Yeah. That is just a gem in that piece. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a certain Irishness to it, though, isn't there? That, like, the team is announced, everybody knows it's not the team, it's in the programme, everyone knows it's not the team, and then you wait for it to actually happen. And we all sort of go along with this charade. We do this in so many aspects of Irish life. It's like the learner driver can't drive on their own. And yet for decades it was like, oh, but obviously I will. I mean, obviously, you know, no one's going to enforce this.
Yeah.
I think it's been enforced now. Like, it's quite a latter late thing. But can I ask just a very quick one? Last GA piece, I was just reading Shane McGrath, page 76, where he was like, and Timmy, you might weigh in on this, given you were probably, you can remember the Kerry five in a row bid.
Yes.
So he's saying, a legend has been forged before our eyes, but it feels as perfunctory as brushing teeth. 10 weeks from today, Dublin should win the All-Ireland Football Championship for the fifth consecutive time. But where is the sense of greatness gathering for one final push for glory? There is none. How does this five in a row compare with Kerry? I would think far more low-key and a sense of inevitability about this one. Oh, what was the feeling?
Oh, no, I wouldn't think so. I mean, I was... No, absolutely, I wouldn't agree with that. I would think that the Kerry five in a row was a banker. I mean, there was no questions.
Right. And were people having the same moans that we are now?
Oh, yeah. That this team, you know, I mean, there was talks about, you know, you should split Kerry up, like, you know, make it, like, you know, they're too good. I mean, absolutely. I was a teenager, or my young adult at the time. There was talks about, you know, you should split Kerry up, they're too good, you know. I mean, I'm from Cork, so we were getting hammered every year by them in one of the finals in that sense. And, you know, it's, and there was a guaranteed expectation they were going to win a 5-0. There was no questions under anybody's mind that this team were not going to beat Offaly in that sense. And if you look at the clip of the game, right, you know, they missed the penalty. I mean, Sheehy missed the penalty, you know, which would have put them out of sight in the game, and they had enough chances. They just didn't, you know. I think psychologically it reminds me of teams that, you know, become afraid to lose. So Kerry were in control of the game, they were playing, they missed the penalty, and all of a sudden, a few minutes ago, they become afraid to lose and they start holding what we have. So they stop doing the things that got them there and they start coming back. And when they came back, eventually, you know, obviously Derby got this infamous goal. So I don't think there's any difference in the expectations.
Really? Okay. I just feel there's a real sense of almost gloom about the whole thing, because whether Dublin do the 5 in a row or not, and they probably will, and that would be great, even if they didn't, I think there's now an increasing sense, given demographics and how sports science has almost taken chance out of the equation and video analysis has taken surprises out of the equation, that whether they do or don't this year, there is a fear that Dublin could win between 6 to 8 All-Irelands every decade.
I'm not so sure. They could. I know exactly where you're coming from on that in terms of the population, but the history of sport is filled with great teams
emerging. Yeah, and that's why I'm giving 4 out of every decade to another team.
And 20 minutes ago, we were talking about Manchester United's decline and how we're pretty much all in agreement that they're not going to be coming back anytime soon. Right.
I know, but I don't think anyone from Abu Dhabi is about to buy Donegal. I wonder, is it a good analogy, like when you can actually pump somewhere full of money and actually buy players in?
I think it is a good point.
Do you sense the kind of?
I do sense that people are fairly, Dublin fans are more than happy to see them continue to win. Yeah. Outside of the Dublin boundaries, people are a bit bored by the whole thing. Like, if you think back between 1997 and 2004, you had 6 different counties winning the Leinster Championship. And Dublin only won one of those 7 Leinster Championships. So, whereas now, since then, actually, they've won all bar one. So there is that sense of inevitability that they're going to continually, the Leinster Championships become redundant in many respects, like, you know. And until last night, you'd have said the same about the Munster Championship in the last 5 years. There's only...
Timmy, you're giving Rory McIlroy one more major. How many All-Irelands a decade are you giving Dublin?
Well, first of all, I think that Dublin have a lot of advantages in the sense of the size of the county is a big advantage.
That's only going one way.
And that's, but it's interesting because, you know, I was in Páirc Cheevan in 83, when Cork Tadhg Murphy got a goal in the last second of the game to deprive Kerry of 9 in a row in Munster, which again, we looked at, you know, but if you take that Kerry team, they came back the following year and won 3 more All-Irelands at a point. Mm-hmm. So I think that the Dublin bandwagon will roll on. I do believe, you know, that I don't think people are bored. I think people are always bored from other counties when one county is dominating. So when Cork were dominating the hurling, we were never bored with it in Cork. Other people were bored. When Kilkenny were dominating the hurling, other people were bored with it, but Kilkenny people were bored. I think the same in Dublin, your point, Guy. The Dublin people aren't bored with this. But I believe that, you know, there won't be a decade go by where Dublin won't win at least 3 All-Irelands.
3,
within the decade. I'm not saying they'll win in consecutive. And I think it's because of 3 factors. First of all, demographics. They just have a lot of people. I do think the Cox-Roscommon transfer will be very interesting to see, you know, the Kerry guy who has gone to Roscommon.
Oh yeah, Cox, yeah.
I think it'll be a very interesting development because that could challenge Dublin at some point in the future. But I think Dublin will, demographics, I think financially they're in the capital, there's more economics available to in that sense. And I think that there's success breeds success, and there's more kids playing GAA now. If you look at, you know, stories about the GAA clubs have really blossomed. So I'd give them 3.
Three a decade. I just worry, like, if you take the analogy, we're about the size of a small state in America. Mm. It's entirely possible the biggest town in that state wins the state championship every year, you know, or give or take.
Yep.
And you just don't want it to become that.
Well, I think that's increasingly becoming the case as well in a number of counties, whereby the county champions tend to be the clubs from the biggest town.
Yeah.
Port Laois being the example that comes, St Lomans in Westmeath being another example.
So will it become a microcosm of that?
But then you still get the exception like Mullinocta in Longford. Well, it could become, yeah, of course it could become. We don't know. We're trying to predict the
future. I'm not convinced, by the way, that Dublin's walk to the five in a row is as clear-cut as ever.
Yeah, I'm not convinced.
I'm not convinced of that. I think Dublin are the best team in the country.
Yeah.
I think they have the best panel in the country. You know, but sport is funny. Sport is fickle.
If Jim Gavin disappears and suddenly they get an idiot in as a manager?
Yeah, there's no doubt a great manager is essential. Yeah.
I think what's helping Dublin in their quest for five in a row is it's not knockout. So you can.
Yes.
I think you've got to give Kerry in that team in their run in this 8 hurlings in 12 years because they won 8 in that 12-year period, 86 backwards. It was knockout, so there was no chance for errors. I think what helps Dublin's cause, you know, the Super 8s, Dublin could lose a game. You know, you look at Hurling, you have Limerick and Cork, my own county, who have lost 2 games so far and could end up winning the All-Ireland, you know. So the rules have slightly changed, but I just think that, you know, I'd love to see Dublin win the 5 in a row if Cork aren't involved. Because I think it's great to see history being achieved. And I think that, you know, that doesn't make them better than the Kerry team in the 70s. They were a phenomenal team in their era. It just means that in this era, they're the best team. So I don't worry, Joe, about, you know, dominance. You know, Liverpool dominated, you know, soccer in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, and it's 30-odd years since they won it. And, you know, if you came out of Anfield in 1990, I think, was it when they won the last title?
Yep.
And said, you will never win a title for 30 years again. We'd have said, ah, guys, that will never happen. You know, and they haven't won in 30 years. So I think that Dublin have a lot of aces, but they have a lot of talent. And at this point, they have all come together, and it'll be an interesting summer.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that there's any difference in the quest that Kerry had and the same interest or lack of interest.
Okay. The clock has come right against us. So just to briefly mention some other pieces we had jotted down and hope to get to. There's a good piece on page 8 of the Sunday Times, Italy, Move On From Sexism Row. It's just a great piece on how the Italians,
the World Cup is on.
Isn't it really good?
It's absolutely brilliant. And I'll tell you what's good. There's a number of things that are good about this piece. You like to read pieces where you know more at the end than you did at the start.
Yeah.
And this is one of those pieces. The bit about how in the 1980s the Italian women's game was just so strong, so popular.
It was a big golden era for it.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
No.
You know?
I knew there's definitely, I was saying to you guys before we came in, there's definitely an Irish player who played over in the Lady Serie A at the time, but massively popular at the time. Front page of the Gazzetta, all the coverage of it. Rebecca Myers is writing about it here. She has done last week about the Women's World Cup. The reason, by the way, is Italy play China on Tuesday. That's the hook.
Yeah, and also that then the sport went into decline when men got involved in terms of the administration of it. And
neglected it effectively.
Yeah, made a mess of it.
Well, she starts off with a hell of a quote from Felice Bellioni.
It's shocking, yeah.
Head of Italy's Amateur Football Association. He denied saying this, but the minutes of the meeting caught it. And no offence intended to anyone, especially when we're talking about Pride Weekend and the GAA getting involved. So this is why one of the reasons the women's grain probably fell into disrepute in Italy. He said, that's enough at one stage. We cannot talk constantly about giving money to this bunch of lesbians, which is an indicator as to why the women's game struggled in Italy for a long time. And they stopped making World Cups for a while, but they're back now. That's the point to me.
Yeah, and I thought, I mean, it's an outrageous comment, and you know, it's very easy to deny it, but you know, it's in the minutes. I thought it was, again, a really interesting piece, the fact that, you know, if you don't have people at the top, you know, with the real genuine interest of a sport, you can very easily lose control of the sport and its demise. To me, I thought there was one other angle I wanted to pick up, Joe, though, was Rose Peralta talked, a former Italian player, about the media coverage and you know, how big it was and that. And you know, and then she throws in a line about you know men going to watch the game for a laugh because women were in shorts, etc. And then she says, there's no play acting in women's sport as in the men's game. The girls are more honest in the field. I'd be very careful in any sport to start, you know, comparing one to the other. Because if you want to compare everything, you know, everything gets compared. So we should just enjoy the women's sport. And at this point, I've watched a lot of the World Cup. And there are times people go down very softly, you know. So, you know, I don't think we can be pious about any sport in that sense. But I think that the sexism row that was evident in Italy was evident in many sports in our country and in other countries. And thankfully we're at the stage now where we're getting beyond that, but it's still part of a journey. But let's enjoy the sport for its own merits. And let's stop trying to have this male-female comparison because, you know, there are differences, okay? I mean, I heard on watching Ascot the other day, one of the analysts say, you know, horse racing is the only sport where there's no, you know, discrimination between men and women, that there's no, you know, advantages, there are disadvantages, okay? But let's just enjoy any sport. So if it's men's sport, if it's women's sports, let's just enjoy the talent we see with the skills that they have at that point in time for what it is. Mm. And stop this comparison of saying, she's not as fast as him, or he's not as dainty as her, or, you know, whatever we say in these things from that point of view. I think that women's, I've really enjoyed the Women's World Cup. I think the skill has been phenomenal. I think there's been some exceptional players. I think the US look to be, you know, like steamrolling their way forward. But there's a couple of surprises, I think, you know, I think that it'll be interesting to see how Phil Neville gets on with his cohorts. Yeah, that's today, I think, isn't it?
Doing a good job, yeah.
Oh, yeah, so. Yeah. But let's just enjoy the sport and let's make sure sexism, anti-male or anti-female, has no place in sport.
30 seconds literally left. We're going to go over to Aaron Kernan and then to Anthony Moyles. There was a line from Tommy Conlon you wanted to mention.
Yeah, it's about Maradona, and I just think it's a brilliant line. It talks about Maradona. When you're on the pitch, life goes away. And that summed up his life, really, that when he was playing, it was all about playing. Everything else, obviously, was a mess. Can I just quickly say, though, a major congratulations to James Sugu. He's a Corkman, by the way, just to clarify that, on a phenomenal achievement in Port Marnock.
I've just been told he's on the show at 5 o'clock.
Oh, well, that's brilliant. And just say, well, give him my congratulations. I thought his performance was exceptional. We talked about McIlroy and some of the other greats in Irish golf. He joins 8 Irish men who've won the amateur, and you know, he's the second Corkman after the famous Jimmy Broome. So it's an amazing achievement. 288 entrants, £90 entry fee.
Yeah.
And now you play Augusta.
Dermot Gleese had that today.
Yeah. You play Augusta, you go to the US Open, and you go to Portrush.
Oh, I'll be offering him the service of my caddy.
Yeah,
it's 5 o'clock if he needs any help.
And I'm also able to drive the car. Joe, I'll be the chauffeur. You know,
we'll
Gary, what will you do?
Zero interest.
Gents, thanks very much. Gary
Thank
Doyle,
you.
Thanks a million for coming in. Tim McCarty, pleasure to have you back again. We'll take a short break and then Ulster Football Final full time with Aaron Kernan. And Anthony Moyles is standing by in Croke Park to give Meathmen hope ahead of throwing at 4.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.